Okay. So anybody who's still a listener, thank you very much for getting through the blackout episode.
We'll be back soon, as Charlie's wife grants him some leave.
Oh, come on. It's not like that. I'm very happy to be on paternity leave.
Okay, but at this point, your like clothes are covered with baby puke, right?
For sure.
Mm.
So this is the last of our flashback. We don't drop on Thursdays, so it can't be a throwback Thursday. We don't drop on Friday, so it can't be a flashback Friday. Oh, this is our last Wayback Wednesday.
Ooh, wow, that's really good.
Kapow. This is the last blackout episode that
And you
Pete
came
and
up
I
with that
recorded.
Sober. I'm impressed.
I am nowhere near sober right now. this is the blackout episode 5, and if I'm reading the list right, it's called You're in Control, which of course is totally not true. But this is from several years ago, and we're just filling time until we can get back to recording.
And cue the drums.
Consiliums.
With Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
Do not attempt to adjust your radio dial, for we are in control.
50,000 watts of control.
Ooh, that's a lot of control, dude. Isn't it?
And pretty soon we'll be at what power rating?
100,000 watts.
Wow.
As soon as somebody signs some paperwork.
Is that all that's standing between us here at WREK and Inside the Black Box for broadcasting at 100,000 watts?
Paperwork, yeah.
Paperwork, wow. Paperwork
stands in between everything, you know.
All right, so what that means is this is the last in our series of blackout shows.
This shouldn't even count as a blackout show, because you know what? There's people hearing this in weird places now.
But because there was great uncertainty on whether or not we were going to be broadcasting at more than 8 watts, we did.
There's a bunch of people who are surprised now that the radio is no longer static. Like, whoa, what?
What's good to hear?
Why is that doing that?
We're blasting up pretty soon at 100,000 watts. But the title of today's program is all about control experiments. We like to call it You're in Control. Any thoughts?
No, I'm so sad now.
He's so sad? You don't like the title? Too bad, because You're in Control. That's what's coming up next on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus asking you to join me in helping to protect our national parks. Our parks will celebrate their 100th anniversary in 2016, but these magnificent places, from Yosemite to Gettysburg, are suffering from numerous challenges such as air and water pollution, development threats outside their boundaries, and inadequate funding. And that's why the National Parks Conservation Association has identified proposed actions to help protect our natural and cultural heritage for future generations. Find out more at www.mpca.org.
Been feeling your traditional American values are under attack by pop country? Well, we've got your vixens.
Oh, what is this that I can't see with icy hands takes hold on me?
That just makes me feel right at home again.
If you want to feel even more at home, tune in every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m. The Back of the Pork Roost, right here on WRK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
If you like country, folk, bluegrass, and American traditional, tune in to the Back of the Pork Roost every Sunday night, 9 to 10 p.m.
For lots of old-timer songs about things like boll weevils, the Great Depression, shipwrecks, train wrecks, drownings, the Civil War, sharecropping, coal mining, and jug bands.
That's 9 to 10 p.m. Sundays right here at WRK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ledevis, and as I have been joined for most of the series of blackout programs, I'm here with Charlie Bennett. Wait, don't tell me. Warrior King,
Warrior
Georgia
King.
Tech Library.
Thank you.
He's thinking of changing the title of all librarians to Warrior King, which means you better watch those overdue books. Would that be correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a Warrior King knows that there are lands that must be conquered, right? And you just need an excuse. So it's like, you know, this copy of the new James Patterson novel's been out a few days too long. We should probably go over there and take control. Look at that, bringing it back.
Troll, bringing it back.
So basically, instead of getting a call from the librarian, some guy with a large, pointy pike will show up and say, "It is I, Charlie the Warrior King, come to retrieve my property."
It's called a knock from the librarian.
I like that. That's really good. So, well, that was good for you to bring it back to Control. So I'd like to talk about Control experiments today.
I think it's funny and coincidental. I had no idea what was going to happen here when I got here. I mean, I just show up and then I see what happens. And,
right. You spray brilliance all over the place.
That's right.
I love that aerosol metaphor. When
Daniel,
came in?
Daniel came in and sprayed engineering
all over the place.
And spray is good too. So check this out. Last night, my wife brought home a soderator, a carbonator.
Do you need a license for that?
I don't know what
I
you
hear
mean.
You get chafing from that soda.
She went and bought
this it. Is the thing that puts, you make your own soda.
It puts the CO2 in the water, right?
This is what your life's come to. This is the most exciting thing in your day. We can make soda now, honey. Let's go.
It was actually quite exciting because we had to experiment. And this is why I'm stalking.
I think the FCC doesn't want to hear about your personal life.
Stay focused,
and experiments with carbonated.
Stay with me. So... There's an instruction in the soderator instruction manual to now everything's going to sound sexual. I'm just going to go with it.
I think it was to start with.
You're supposed to press the button short and firm. Yeah. See, there's no getting away from it.
If there are any middle school classes listening now, you can just turn the radio off.
you carbonate your water with 3 bursts of CO2.
Okay.
Right. And you're supposed to hit the button until there's a buzz, which signifies the end of that carbonation process. Now, if it doesn't buzz, and you're just holding down the button and it's carbonating, there's a certain sense of, is this too long? Is this too short? What am I doing?
Then the house explodes. Well, and you're calling the insurance company.
We had a moment, and there was tonic water all over the place. You know, we soaked the instruction manual, got a bunch on the floor, you know, just kind of bam, right, all over. And I said, well, I don't know what we did wrong. I don't know if that was far too much or, you know, if that was just a mistake on our part. And my wife said, well, we don't have a control group for any of this.
Did she really say that?
Yeah.
And this was just the other night?
This was last night. That's what I'm saying. It's a coinky dink.
What are you, Ned Flanders now? One more time.
Anyway.
I'm getting lightheaded.
So a control group. And here's the thing, you know, that she's completely right. We don't have anything to compare it to.
Yeah,
you
that's
have
what a control experiment is.
All the time. You're supposed to have those. And when people don't have them, then they get into serious trouble. Because if I just said, oh, every time I use it, it sprays all over the place, then I'll never use it again, right? Or if I just say, oh, you know, that was just a mistake on the machine's part, and I keep doing it like that.
And what would your control experiment be? The soderator being used by a competent human being? Would that be the control experiment?
I think
factory technician?
Holding the thing down until it buzzed would probably be a start.
Oh, okay. So what, you missed the buzz? You went past the buzz?
I got to tell you, the instruction manual for the soderator, and that might not be the right brand name, but I don't care. It's the soderator now. The instructions kept implying that there would be clicks and noises and thunks and things like that and buzzes, and none of them ever happened.
Right, and Gene Wilder on the top of Frankenstein Castle going, "It's alive!"
You know, put it all together, right? So it said, do this, and then push it down until there's a click signifying that it's, chassis
Something
has connected.
Something substantial, a substantial mechanical event.
There was no click. There was such a disappointing lack of click that I have to make sure that I don't say a strong expletive to go with there was no click.
Okay, gotcha.
I mean, because there's no click.
Okay.
There was no click.
I'm gathering from you there was indeed no click.
There was no click, and we were told there would be a click, and that, in fact, was the thing that was supposed to signify the end of the process.
Wow.
And it wasn't there.
So, as always, you very eloquently illustrated the fundamental nature of the topic that we're discussing today, right?
I like to make it hard on you.
Yeah, no, it's good. I mean, every time you are putting something together, and let's be honest, instructions are usually the last thing people pay attention to. I used to work in the software industry, and we had some very good documentation people. And they did a very good job writing documentation. But the problem is, whenever we had a bad fiscal quarter, the CEO, who was not too bright but shall remain nameless because I don't need another lawsuit, would like fire the documentation people like a month before the release. And we'd be like, look, you can't
just
really
to get
do
them
that.
Off the books.
Well, yeah. Just and then the point is we'd realize we have a release. You got to hire them back as consultants and you got to hire them back with extra money because they're not getting the benefits. So you got to pay them more. And it was just crazy. I was actually putting together a very expensive laboratory instrument, and their manual didn't match the interface for the instrument.
Just start going with this looks like it would connect appropriately, that sort of thing.
Well, I could give it another name and say I reached deep down into my technical acumen and tried to look for examples. But yeah, we were just okay,
throwing it
close
together.
Enough.
When we were putting together the soderator, I did say we're going to have to go all IKEA on this, meaning we're just going to have to trust in these directions because they didn't make sense and certain things were not explained. And it was just it was a little bit like do it until it's done.
Right.
Was sort of the way the instructions worked. And with IKEA, right, they have a very sort of that goes there. Just put it there. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. Screw that in.
Right.
Click that together. Mm-hmm. That's what it's supposed to look like. And the little guy scratching his head and then calling IKEA. I don't think anyone's ever called IKEA because they couldn't put their table together. What do you think?
Are you implying that cam lock bolts are not beyond the... Actually, there's stuff that's beyond a lot of Americans, and I'm sure cam lock bolts are in there.
That is not what I'm saying, although that's an interesting thought that you just had. Now, I am saying that I don't think anyone's ever resorted to calling IKEA when they were having problems. I think that they resort to using a hammer.
Right.
Or calling
an
awl
or an ice pick or something like
that.
Or
just saying to themselves, well, that seems like enough.
I believe you are correct. So, but here's the interesting thing, and let's look at this as a science topic. Why did you buy the carbonating device?
It was actually economics.
Please explain.
One Perrier a day, right, times 5, times 52, is more than the cost of a soderator.
Oh, wow. So can you do, like, flavored stuff? Like, you mentioned tonic water. I mean, tonic water is more than just carbonated water. Or were you talking about carbonated water?
Oh, no, we started with carbonated water. We did tonic, and one of the mistakes I made was just diving into the whole tonic concept because they're very strict. Mm-hmm. They tell you things like, be sure to slowly pour the syrup into the tilted bottle. And slowly and tilted both are in big, bold, screaming red, flaming letters.
You otherwise, what will ensue?
Don't tell you. They say don't try to carbonate juice, but they don't tell you why. They say don't do this, don't do that, but they don't tell you what the reaction or the end result. So then I still don't know if we sprayed tonic all over the kitchen floor because we did it wrong or because we did it right, and it's just that's what happens. I don't know.
So you're actually revealing more questions than answers with this fascinating topic. And if you're listening to our program, and you are today because we're broadcasting 50,000 watts here on WRAK.
Yeah, but everyone's surprised that they're listening.
And you have a question or a comment, or in particular, you have any idea why it is a heinous crime against humanity to carbonate juice. Give us a call here at the studio, especially if you're listening live Wednesdays noon to 1. And if you're not listening live Wednesday noon to 1,
call
and you call up
anyway, you'll
get an interesting conversation. That I can assure you of. But give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. Gosh, if I had to guess, I don't know. I mean, let's think about why juice is different than soda. Juice has higher viscosity.
Higher viscosity and
thicker.
Sugar.
It's got stuff in it.
Sugar was the thing that the salesman mentioned when he said you couldn't carbonate juice.
Okay.
Which then made me think, well, is that why you can't carbonate liquor?
But isn't syrup just all sugar?
Well, see, that's the thing. The syrup goes in after the water's carbonated.
But beer is carbonated, and so are wine coolers for those that have a penchant for that sort of thing.
So I don't know, right? So you carbonate the water.
We've got a call now. I'm sure this is an expert on juice carbonation.
Here's a great thing, too. It says to shake the carbonated water after you've put the syrup in it. And we had a moment where we thought, well, if you shake it up, you decarbonate it in some way.
To a small degree, yes.
Yeah. So what's the level of shaking?
But only an itty bit. But you want to shake because you want to get good mixing in. Was that our juice carbonation expert on the line?
They were wondering why carbonation causes kidney stones.
Oh, nice. I don't think it's carbonation. I think it's actually the minerals in club soda that can cause kidney stones. But that's just a guess, and no one should listen to
me. Are there minerals in club soda?
Dude, yeah. There's like bicarbonates and whatnot.
Oh, so absolutely. Carbonate salts actually contribute to that. And probably one of the biggest things that brings about kidney stones are things for the carbonate and other calcium salts.
Look at that. That was like Wonder Twins power right there.
Calcium salts to nucleate. And actually, I believe it's the tannins in tea are particularly bad. So my bout with a kidney stone was drinking a lot of tea and taking a lot of Tums.
Oh, yeah, chalk.
Calcium
you were
salt.
Eating whole
yeah,
bunch
I was eating chalk. And then I was, well, you know, which at least adjusted the pH in my
stomach. So let's jump back real quick just to make it clear. Now that all the information has come together, mm-hmm. carbonated water doesn't give you kidney stones, but ingesting a lot of carbonates, is that the right?
Actually, I think it could be carbonates, but it's specifically calcium carbonate.
Calcium carbonate, which is in club soda and possibly in some other mineral.
What is in club soda?
Yeah. It's a salt.
So the reason it's economical for you to carbonate your soda is...
Wait. No soda.
Oh.
Just water.
Sparkling water.
Did you consider that they don't want you to carbonate juice because it'll be awesome and you'll stop buying their syrup?
That's the other thing. You know, if the reason they're not telling us is because they don't
Are
want us to
discover... Are you implying a scandal, Trent? A cover-up of some sort?
You know, if everybody started carbonating like vodka, it would be like, well, no one would ever go outside again.
I'm sure someone tried to carbonate vodka, because carbonation and vodka have been around for a long time.
But no one has ever said, don't carbonate vodka. That's terrible.
It's because you just mix vodka with club soda.
Juice. I mix juice with tonic water or sparkling water. Yeah. And I like that. That is good, actually, because it lightens the juice. But here's the thing. Just make carbonated water and mix it with juice. That, I can say empirically, in my own opinion, is an excellent beverage.
You got a calculator in that little... digital device you got on your hip?
I probably do.
You know what? You got a calculator in your head. What's 250 times 52?
250 times... I can't do that right now. Are you kidding? I'm so sleep deprived. Okay, so 250 times 5 by 4, so you're looking at 1,000, so that's 1,250 times 10, 12,500?
12,500.
I left off the 2, but close enough.
Okay, 12,500.
So you're getting your Perrier bill.
This is a club soda. Mm-hmm. Just club soda. 6-pack of club soda a week.
Yeah.
Which if you're mixing your vodka or your whiskey or any other delightful beverage with your club soda,
right.
You probably are going through a 6-pack. You've already paid for your first round of the Soderator by buying...
But you realize the cost associated with that is mainly transportation of taking water, which is quite dense, and moving along. Trucks...
Nice, even better. So you know what? I'd like to change my answer. To save the environment, Pete, that is why we bought the Soderator.
Indeed, ladies and gentlemen. Today is an environmental show. We're talking about the soda. Is it even the Soderator? I think you just made that up.
I am a warrior king, and I will not be using someone else's product from some other place.
Carbonator Maximus or
something. So we did have a caller question. They want to know, what is the difference between seltzer and club soda?
It's the salts.
Yeah, it's the other stuff that's in it. Right, so everything is just carbonated water, but it's, you know, whether it's cola, orange soda, whatever, it's the other stuff.
So seltzer is straight up bubbly water with probably nothing in it. Probably it's purified water that's been carbonated.
Right.
Club soda has that slightly different bite because it has, and again, I don't know the chemicals, I'm back.
Yeah, club soda is different than tonic water, which has quinine in it.
And other stuff. But but the club soda has... calcium bicarbonate or something along
that. And most of those, at least tonic water, is lightly sweetened, too. Very light. Because you can
tonic
buy
is.
Diet tonic water. Club soda is not.
Club soda is not.
Right. But I love tonic water, and I like drinking it because it's less sugar than soda, but it's lightly sweetened, so it's not
too
bad.
You get a little bubbly, and you get that bite, too, so you get the pain and torment that you expect every morning.
What is this bite thing?
Quinine in tonic water.
That has a bite? You're right. It's a little bit bitter.
Are you so burnt out?
It's a little bit bitter.
And so beat down that you don't think tonic has a bite.
Look, I'm so burnt out and beat down. You're lucky I got out of bed this morning.
Pete, you do know that tonic is not the part that gets you drunk, right?
Have you just been drinking?
Yes, I do.
Because when you separate that, the two.
I drink. So here is
I
my trick.
I think you might be just drinking the gin.
There's empirical evidence for that. Because you don't drink them separately.
Yeah, so I am not one of these hard liquor guys.
Control
I can't
group.
Drink
yeah.
vodka by itself. But I will tell you this. Coming from a long line of alcoholics, I know the trick. You go to a conference, and maybe Trent hasn't learned this yet based on the shape he's in when he comes back from this Vegas security conference.
Club soda with a slice of lime.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. No one can tell the difference between a vodka and tonic and a gin and tonic and just tonic water with the same slice of lime or lemon in it.
Do you think that's true?
Well, when they're looking at you.
Yeah,
but as you go to all these hospitality suites at these big meetings, and I might have one, maybe two drinks, but I can't be drinking all night. But you like to have something in
your
hand.
You don't want to be the narc. You want to look like you're doing it.
Well, but I like tonic water with ice and a twist. That's a refreshing drink. I could drink that all night, and then you have a drink in your hand, so if someone comes up to you that you just can't stand, you're like, I better go freshen my drink, and you... That's why people have drinks in their hands. Let's be honest.
Now, you do know that some people think that, you can't smell vodka or...
And you can. Vodka actually has a flavoring in it. Not as much as gin in other places, but it does.
I just want to toss this in. Yeah, you can't really smell vodka until you sweat it.
Really? I don't really want to go down that road. I don't want to know what empirical observation you made when you woke up in the gutter one day and goes, I smell like vodka. All right, can we do our favorite segment to start the show off with?
Science in the news.
And I think now that we're broadcasting 100,000 marks, we need to sound, I think now that we do that, we need to do the Dateline New York Times, September 21st, by James Gorman. Amorous squid seeks partner. Any sex will do.
We were talking about this off air a little bit earlier.
Talking about gay squid.
And you said something horrifying to me.
Did I? What did I say?
You said that one of the octopus's tentacles.
It's octopi, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, no, it's plural. No, he's using it possessively.
I am. I am
one of the octopuses.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Sounds like a James Bond film.
One of the tentacles that is the octopuses.
Is his junk.
Is his junk.
That's what I heard. If we have any octopi experts out there, please call in 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468.
See, that means that almost undoubtedly I have eaten octopi peni. And I didn't know that. I mean, I'm okay.
Now you're making up plural words.
I'm okay with having eaten all parts of an animal at one point.
How
is that any worse than a hot dog or something?
Yeah, exactly. Because hot dogs.
Well, I don't eat hot dogs, right? I mean, here's the thing. Like when I had lamb fries at Holman and Finch, which are what you joke about lamb fries being, I knew what they were and I ate them and that was good, right? But this means now that when I've been eating an octopus stew or, you know, fried octopus or whatever I've been eating without knowing it, without being properly prepared for it.
Well, so if you're willing to eat the whole animal, you knew it was there anyway.
You ever
cooked the whole octopus?
I'm not. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not,
well, there you go.
I'm not willing to eat the whole animal in the sense that, I won't eat a skull. You know?
But I have eaten the tentacles
of
octopus.
That seems prejudiced.
Right. You can get that at a sushi bar. It's a very common dish.
Yeah, I ate a whole baby octopus once, and, you know, it was weird. It was full of weird shapes that kind of moved around that didn't really – that couldn't chew, and that was odd. But it was a baby octopus, and, you know.
That makes it better.
It does a little bit. It makes it more cruel. And so I wasn't
grow up and start causing trouble. Let's get them baby octopi.
Do you know that I am terrified of octopuses?
I do know. And I think
is
you should
have
used the word octopi at that point.
I actually think that first off, I think that whole eye pluralization thing, I think it's a lie. And I'm okay with anybody disagreeing.
And he's a librarian, folks, so it must be true.
Actually, if you go MLA-ing and check out the whole, that's Modern Language Association, and you start looking into how we're supposed to pluralize things, there are several sets of rules. And anybody who gets really cranked up about, it's octopi, so much that they want to get in your face, you should tell them that they are a pedant.
What exactly does that mean, a pedant?
Very pedantic?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, I would agree with that. But I'm not getting you in your face. I'm just using it for joke value.
I'm having fun. Yeah, absolutely. I am scared that the octopi are going to rise up and take over. As soon as they figure out SCOBA, self-contained over-water breathing apparatus, they're going to take us down.
Write that down. I got to write that down. We invented a new acronym, SCOBA.
If SCOBA is self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, then the octopuses...
It is correct.
They are putting together self-contained overwater breathing apparatuses.
Okay.
SCOBA.
Octopus breath.
Yeah, if you say octopuses and you know that the other person knows that you're talking about multiple octopus, then you can just chalk it up to vernacular or something.
It really should be okay, shouldn't it?
Sure.
Yeah. And if you say octopi, someone knows that too.
Maybe it's not entirely correct, but if the person gets the point, that's the point of language in the first place.
But it's a little Latinate.
Yes.
And pretentious.
It is.
Octopi. Are you done? Because Mr. Gorman's article is not about octopi. It's about squid.
Let's hear about the homosexual squid.
He begins, a 5.5-inch deep sea squid that lives a solitary life up to half a mile down in the dark waters of the Pacific Ocean.
Is it bad that everything you just said sounded sexual to me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
But this octopus is the latest addition to hundreds of species that are known to engage in same-sex sex. A lot of sex in that.
Yeah,
that sentence there.
This is not a surprise, is it?
No, it says, over the years, scientists have added one creature after another to the list, making it clear that although nature abhors a vacuum, it seems to be fine with just about everything else, including your weird penchant for carbonated soda. But here's the critical point. Male squid, for example, pay no attention to the sex of other squid. Understandably so. They live alone in the dark. Males and females are hard to tell apart, and only occasionally do squids pass in the night.
That far sounds like better... computer science students.
You know what I said? I was eating lunch with my colleagues, and I said, sounds like engineers to me. Far better to risk wasting a few million sperm than to miss out on a chance to reproduce. Again, sounds like computer science students. All right, we're going to get calls about that one. But
I think you're in a dangerous area here, just like
all
the squid.
I'm saying is, and this is something that people need to know about nature, and Julia Kubanik and other guests who have talked about this really point out that nature's messy. Biology's messy. And through that messiness, we get all sorts of weird derivatives. We get redundant processes in physiology. And the messiness may be difficult to understand, but it actually makes us very robust.
The first time I ever heard this concept was actually about the way the ants walk.
Really?
Yeah, because someone was talking about, there was some huge study on how do ants walk in preparation for the moonwalker. Mm-hmm. Like maybe we're going to do it that way. Maybe we're going to model our moonwalker over insects because they seem to be able to walk over anything. And what they discovered is that the reason that ants can walk over anything is because ants really can't walk at all. They basically just sort of tumble all the time. They're terrible walkers. Everything they do is kind of clumsy. But it's equally clumsy no matter what the terrain.
Right. So what you're saying is it's kind of inefficient, but that means they can adapt and adjust. They're very robust at different types of terrain.
Yeah. And so the summation of this study was insects can't really walk very well at all.
Right. I agree with that. And people have programmed robots. They've taken, you know, 8-legged and 6-legged robots and programmed them to walk. And then what they do is they tear off a leg or two and they try to invent algorithms to get them to figure out how to walk without it.
Are
and
they
come
able
up.
To?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They adapt very, very well. And it's sort of a balance between efficiency and robustness. So, and they kind of look at, see, what would an intelligent algorithm teach this robot to do? And they're surprised by some of these things. So we learn a lot about robustness versus efficiency. And we keep talking about nature being perfect. No way,
it's
not even
close. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard that joke with the Segway, that you can go through the trouble of making the thing stay up on two wheels with a gyroscope and all that stuff. Or like any good engineer would just put a third wheel and call it a day.
Yeah, right.
And there is a third wheel version of a Segway that people use all the time.
Hey, speaking of Segways.
Ooh, which one? The motorized vehicle or the, what is Segway, a literary device? What would we call that?
You're being a pedant.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta.
And if you're a pedant, or even if you're not, and you have got a question or comment for us here on Inside the Black Box, and you're listening live Wednesdays noon to 1, give us a call here at the studio, 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468.
So, I do think that Segway is a literary term, but I can't be sure. Okay. Without a computer in front of me...
I'm being a pedant. Being a pedant.
I'm like 50%
like a warrior
less
with a sword.
Effective. Yes. Because I don't know anything, right? But I can look something up.
But
in
you're a warrior king of the library.
I know how to look it up, man. But I can't right now because I have no internet access. I have no reference work here.
But the point I want to make is in reference to a milestone. At midnight last night... Don't Ask, Don't Tell went bye-bye.
Nice.
And here we are, scientists saying, you know, every year we add more and more creatures to the gay animals of the gay animal kingdom. It's like the regular animal kingdom, but more feng shui. It's
now, let me ask you
decorated.
About that. Is it that there are gay animals, if we looked at them anthropomorphically, we would say that they were homosexual? Or is it that there are homosexual acts in nature that are sort of undifferentiated?
I think it's that we have developed this sexual reproductive drive to drive the procreation of the species, which is obviously very important. Those that do not have that drive, and that drive manifests itself in many different ways. It's just basically you make animals really horny and there's nothing you can do about it. And if occasionally it's a same-sex thing, they don't really care.
Or a different species thing.
Or a different species
thing.
Because
I think everyone's had the experience or seen it.
Of your neighbor's dog going at it when you come over for the tea, the afternoon tea, and suddenly Fido, get down.
Dogs will try and
procreate with anything.
Thank you, yes. Yeah, I had a moment where I didn't know what... I almost... Trent just hit the dump button now for me.
Did you hit the dump button?
No.
Okay, you were about to, though, because you knew it was...
I was teetering on the edge there.
So the point is, biology is very messy, and this is what happens. And what I'd like to say to people is... And I actually tried to bring in some studies, but we could have dedicated two shows to this of, you know, congenital versus environmental and homosexuality. The point is, homosexuality is simply a fact of biology. I don't think anyone disputes that. It's just a fact of biology. It happens, so why deny it? It's like denying that the planets and solar systems and galaxies are moving apart at a very rapid rate.
Well,
it's just the way it is.
That too.
Do they deny that?
Oh, yeah.
There are no people that still believe the sun revolves around the Earth, do they?
But no, you said it's flying away from each other, right?
Yeah.
There are people who are against that.
But whether or not light is red-shifted not a matter of belief. Have you read on this trend?
I have read about the fights that people have had about the expanding universe versus the non-expanding universe.
Oh, well, but people fight about whether or not it's neutral, it's open, or it will eventually collapse on itself. We don't know what the end point is because that's hard to predict. But it is expanding, at least locally. By us, right?
Because
all the light is shifted to a lower frequency, meaning it's moving far apart. And it's moving farther apart at a speed that it's least detectable relative to the speed of light, which is, you know, it's not like 3 minutes and 3 feet an hour or something. It's fast. So we can detect it.
It's funny. You say 3 feet. It's not 3 feet an hour. It's fast. But I feel like 3 feet an hour is really fast for nature. Because of geologic stuff.
Oh, yeah. And if you're, like, on the rack, that would be, that would be fast.
That would be terrible. That would be terrible.
The point I'm trying to make is over the years, thousands and thousands of years, science discovers something, right? Whatever that is,
I'll go so far as to say people engaged in science.
Right. But invariably, they fight us for anywhere between 5 years and 500 years, and eventually we win. We always win because it's logic that's observable, empirical
fact.
Yeah, but
you win after you're dead.
Do we win after we're dead? No, there are still people that are alive who said, look, being gay is simply a matter of biology. You're not a menace to society. There are many studies that say the Israeli army did fine after we integrated gay people.
Do you think that the fact that this has been... You say won, right? Don't you mean, by winning, don't you mean where it becomes accepted as part of the narrative of the human condition?
Yeah.
Right. So I don't think you could say that you've won on the case of homosexuality.
Well, we've won on gays in the military, at least.
Gays in the military, but that's very, I mean, there's going to be...
Well, you got to crawl before you can walk, dude.
As a warrior king, I am interested in using the word won in the correct way.
Okay. Well, okay, so...
So you've done well.
Basically, I want to say, in your face. That's really what I... Just the whole point of this segment was to say, in your face. You know, but that's what I'm saying. You know, they threatened to burn Galileo at the stake, and he was eventually proved right, and Newton was proved right. And, you know, there was a time on this planet where people thought that some people were inferior to others simply because of the color of their skin. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we have dispelled that now. Right, and that doesn't mean that people can't be different, but this whole inferior race, women can do anything men can do, and they can dress while doing it.
But there's always insurgencies, aren't there? Like that bell curve stuff. You remember the
bell curve book? Ridiculous. Yeah,
it was ridiculous, but it was published, and there were people, I think, high profile pundits, right, who wrote defenses.
Oh yeah, we do make mistakes.
Can I say a name of someone? Can I say that person's?
We're not doing a call to action, though. I mean,
I was just thinking. I don't want to. You were saying stuff about libel. Anyway, high-profile pundits delivered defenses of the bell curve, and the bell curve basically said, "Look, we've got studies that shows that black people are dumb." That was the bell curve's general.
Yeah, and a lot of people accepted that.
Well, I don't think they accepted it so much as they said, "Oh, thank God, someone has said
what
I wanted."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there's always these insurgencies of, oh, look, look, someone has presented the prejudice that I hold with scientific data. Good, we're back to where we started, you know?
Yeah, and this data is data, and sometimes data indicates one thing or another, but you have to look and see what did or didn't you control for in that experiment.
Bringing it back, bringing it back.
Talk about it. Call back on that one, baby.
Hey, Pete, what's a control group?
So, oh, God, that's a good question. What is a control group?
Could you give a real-world example? If someone was in their house trying to figure something out,
yeah, so
what might be a control group?
The control groups are very easy to understand. So, for example, you want to test the effect of a variable. So, I don't know. We're going to get to this essay in a minute. Yeah, I brought an essay with me, dude. Where is it? Now I'm looking through my notes. I'm like, got to stack it. By Frank Fleming, a political satirist who wrote in the New York Post on, this was on September 11th, 2011, that people have alleged that Rick Perry and others like him are anti-science. That's horrible. Science is extremely important. It's given us microwaves, dinosaurs, and the Mr. Wizard show, and medicines, except for the homeopathic ones. Whoa, he's going right for the jugular there.
Yeah, did this guy go to college or something?
So it's critical that we accept science's conclusions. For example, if we don't agree on the age of the Earth, how will we know what to do when the Earth tries to buy liquor? And without knowledge of evolution, what species goes extinct? Once a species goes extinct, how do we notify the next of kin?
Is this you or is this
No, this is Frank Fleming. I love this essay.
One of my colleagues sent this to me. For your money.
But despite the obvious importance of science, one group of people does everything in pure defiance of scientific methods, politicians. Right? And he actually goes on to talk about control experiments. He goes, so a control experiment would be... doing two groups. One group, you try the thing on it. For example, farm subsidies, right? He actually says, you know, should we take one state or a couple states or one section of the country, do farm subsidies there, then don't do farm subsidies elsewhere and see if there's a difference.
Well, now, will that work in terms of, you know, the states are a dependent system, right?
Mm-hmm.
They interact with each other. Can you do an experiment where the control groups affect each other?
No, in fact, they should be isolated. They shouldn't affect each other.
Well, also, the states aren't the same. They have different laws and all kinds of such, too.
And immediately what you're seeing is the problem with control experiments. Control experiments are easy if you're doing it on a ceramic composite material, right?
And if you're able to assume a spherical cow.
Right. So the point is you take your spherical cow, and then you take your spherical cow made out of a polymer ceramic composite, and you test the modulus, right? You literally squeeze the cow. Which one's harder to squeeze? That's the higher modulus.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you put an epoxy coating on a floor, and then you do some abrasion testing, right? So you literally take some object and
scrape the same floor somewhere else.
The same floor without the epoxy coating. Yeah. And if you find that the epoxy coating makes a 2% difference in the lifetime of the floor, but it triples the cost of the floor, that's saying this is not worth doing, right?
Oh,
that's
yeah, nice.
What a control experiment. There's two big problems with control experiments. One, you have to change only one variable. And that is the reason why in education we hardly ever do well-controlled experiments. And I'm in the middle of writing a grant on this, and I realize we want to do sort of this design innovation thing. And I was explaining to Lou Lefton, my colleague on this, that if we do this, Lou, we're going to have to teach the one course and the other. You got to teach both because you have to control for instructor.
Right.
So the easiest way to shift data is to, you know, take a really more burnt out than me, right? A burnt out instructor and have him teach the control group. And he's like, well, he comes in, he's bitter and angry. He's got vodka and tonic in his coffee.
He's shooting straight quinine into
his arm. Right, exactly. And he's just like... You know, he walks in, you people are undergraduates. I hate undergraduates. That means I'm going to be enjoying this. That kind of guy. And then you put the upbeat guy who believes in the method to teach the new method. Of course the new method is going to come out. Same thing with the bell curve. You compare people that had access to really good educational facilities people that didn't, and of course it's going to show that.
There's a webcomic, XKCD. Have you heard of that?
No.
There's
some underground dude that I...
Not really.
No, pretty mainstream
I'm not
now.
Hip enough to...
No, pretty mainstream for geeks,
that explains why I haven't heard of him.
Yeah. I'm not going to do the thing where I describe a cartoon to you. I'm just going to make
Thank
the point
you.
That he made in the cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
some people, if they see a man make a math mistake, they will say, wow, you're no good at math.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they see a woman make a math mistake, they'll say, women are no good at math.
Ah, yes. Okay.
So that's, and that's the problem.
Yeah, right? That is the problem.
And so that person, that prejudiced person, should probably, what, watch 1,000 women do math problems? Is that the...
I mean, we tried to talk about this a couple of shows ago, that often there are unexpected results. So, for example, I was just analyzing some data on us using humorous improvisation to come up with new technical ideas. And I took my data and I split it by gender. I put men and women in two different categories, compared them, and to 95% confidence, none of them were different. If you go down to the 90% confidence level, there's only one that's different. And actually, if we accumulate all the data, that will no longer be different either. This was only on a 20-person group. But if you pool your data and get 100, 200, that's no longer different either. But it was interesting. The one that was different was, do you think you're funny? Men thought they were funnier than women. Which, again, that's maybe a cultural bias. I really don't think
that's a total cult. Have you been listening to the Marc Maron podcast yet?
No, I haven't. But you told me to. I should, because I like Marc Maron.
And that thing you just described, that's what's going... I mean, that's one of the things he tries to talk about. But going back to what I was saying, though, is do you get a control group if you compare a bunch more people, or is it more complicated than that? Like, is it a control group if you add...
That the variable is change.
Is it even possible to get a good control group when you're talking about people in social science?
Trent, as always, you've made a brilliant point. You know, with a piece of plastic that you're going to test, and say you test 10 of them, and you make them all the same way, and you look at them, and they appear to be the same way, and all their other properties are essentially the same with a very tight tolerance, that's easy. People are messed up. That would be the technical term. I'm sticking with that.
They're all unique little snowflakes.
Yeah, so the problem is you need at least two groups. You can actually have a third group. There's something called a negative control where you don't do the thing that you did. And then you can actually have a positive control where you did another method that's supposedly the state of the art, right? So, for example, you can take people with a certain illness, and the negative control is you do nothing. The positive control is you use a standard, very effective treatment. And then the experimental one is the one you use a different treatment. And what you can do is you can see, okay, is it better than nothing? Okay, that's good. Is it better than the other treatment? Is it the same as the other treatment? If it's not different than the other treatment, but it costs half the amount, or there's less pain, or there's less discomfort, or it doesn't involve a suppository, which nobody likes, then you know. That would be... what do they call that? Medication compliance. There's actually a term for that.
Wait, for suppositories?
Well, for drugs in general. That part of the reason that my colleague Mark Prosnitz and a lot of people here at Tech and other places work on transdermal drug delivery and other things like that. You know, patches. Patches are easy. Put a patch on, you forget about it. Is because people don't take their pills. And if it's a suppository, I think I understand why. But just generally, you're too busy, you're too lazy, you don't want to do it, it's a pain in the butt. Some people have a hard time swallowing pills.
And anybody who has a problem believing that should just think about the way people brush or floss, because that's really the same thing. I mean, by only brushing and not flossing, you're not in medical compliance. You're not using treatment the way it should be. And
right, but brushing is easier than flossing.
And the reason you don't floss is because it's just kind of irritating.
Right.
So I realize now what I was trying to say earlier when you were talking just now, is that it's the aggregate is important also with the control group.
Right? So what do you mean the aggregate?
That when you say you're trying to get the variable out of the way, right? You're not just this one incident and this one incident. It's many incidences.
You will take an average to take only one sample. And this is the lesson of this one-man show I'm working on that we're going to do at the New Orleans Fringe Festival. Feel the power of the dork side. The importance of statistics in our data-driven society. I'm probably going to get stoned. I'm going to get turned on like a pack of dingoes in the parking lot. This is a first, but I'm trying to get people excited about statistics. Trent's thinking he'll be dead before he comes back.
You're going to get turned on like a pack of dingoes? Could you explain that, please?
Turned on by a pack of dingoes.
No,
it's like getting turned on by a pack of dingoes.
They will turn on me as an attacking...
The dingoes will attack you.
This is nothing sexual. Okay. Man, your mind is in the gut.
Actually, I was thinking drugs, so you're the one in the gut.
I'm just thinking, maybe the dingo ate your libido. I don't know. But
hey, that was a very serious story, man. Dingo ate that woman's baby.
Sorry, I didn't mean to insult anyone here. But let me go back to Trent's.
That's
a brilliant comment.
Huh? Which one was that?
You had a brilliant comment because you said... Can you ever control for people? It's really difficult.
It kind of reminds me of like one of those things that makes mathematicians cringe, but engineers are okay with. It's a process that's not perfect, but it still works.
Right, exactly. But if you want to compare, so what variable are we doing? Okay, so people that had farm subsidies and people that didn't, right? In effect, what Frank Fleming suggests, he goes, were farm subsidies first tried on monkeys, Social Security, bank bailouts? No, the unscientific politicians went straight to trying all their ideas on humans. And now we have a bunch of bankrupt people instead of harmless bankrupt monkeys. But he does go on to say that, what does he say? There's a good thing later in this thing. He goes,
Does he eventually suggest eating Irish babies?
No, no, he doesn't. Or dingoes eating babies. But the problem with testing political ideas on monkeys is that forcing them to go billions in the debt would violate animal cruelty laws. The only ones we're allowed to do that on are people.
Right, we had a caller question. It was, isn't statistics fundamentally constrained by the sample size? Or not the sample size, but like the sample you pick.
Well, it's limited by that. Absolutely.
And,
so,
and not statistics so much, but what you can draw from statistics.
Yes, right. The results of statistics.
Your conclusions.
So the reason why Trent's comment was utterly brilliant, ladies and gentlemen, is because it is so hard to control for people. So you could never take one person with farm subsidies and one person without. Right, because people are different. You couldn't take two. You couldn't take three. You have to take a huge sample.
But then that's what we were talking about. It was like with states. Like you would have to
and
actually
have to
choose different counties.
Okay, so the caller wanted to clarify, is the validity of statistics, or how's the validity of statistics affected by the samples?
It goes down with smaller sample size.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And would you say, and this is just me kind of goofing on that, does it actually make it difficult sometimes when you have too big a sample size? Hmm. I mean, is it possible that when you're, like, if you're polling people, and you poll so many people that you get down to, like, 50-50, mm-hmm. it's like you haven't found anything out, right? You've just found out that people are different. Can that happen with actual statistics, like statistical research? Can you just have so much that it's no longer useful?
Let me just say, in the vernacular of your theme for the show, in statistics, size does matter. And bigger is always better. Unlike nanotechnology, ironically.
Nicely done, Pete. I actually did not think that you could get a penis joke out of what I just said.
Did I say that? I didn't say that.
I think the probability of that is low.
The point is, bigger is always better.
See, now we're talking about significant digits.
Yes. Especially on an octopus.
Yeah, I was going to... This thing reminded me of, I guess it was a probability or a related scam that I don't know. I'm not sure if people know, but so it's say you're at your home and you get a letter, and the letter has like it says like the Browns are going to beat the Falcons this week or something like that, and then it's correct, and you get a letter the next week and it says so and so is going to beat, or they're going to beat this person this week, and it's correct, and then you get the letter the next week for the whole football season, you get a letter, and it actually says who's going to beat who that week, and so you can bet on it.
Oh,
and in the end, it says,
pay me however
many thousands of dollars. And
I'll give you my secret.
And I'll send you the thing, and I'll send you the ones winning for next year. Right. I mean, that seems, you know, it seems pretty good. He predicted all the winning things.
Because he sent out every combination to thousands of people.
If you look at all the combinations, there's only thousands, and that's not that much postage, and you're guaranteed to get the money at the end because if someone is convinced that you
won.
But
if 50 people got all the winning letters, half of them sent you $1,000
getting the mail, you only see the winning things, but as you're the person pulling the scam, you're sending thousands of things, and thousands of things is cheaper than like someone giving the money at the end.
Right? I think we should go back over that again very quickly. So, I mean, the scam from the other side is that... You send
every combination.
Yeah, you send everyone. You send half the people. The Browns won, and half the people the Bills won. And I'm sure that those aren't.
And as soon as you get one that lost for a week, you
stop
that
sending that person. Yeah, and so guessing essentially, you're slowly winning.
So you're not
down
guessing,
here.
But they feel like you're guessing.
Yeah. No one should do that. That's a bad thing.
But it's one of those things where it seems like a trick of probability when it's really just, it's actually a scalable thing.
It's actually a strategy.
Yeah, it's actually a strategy.
But isn't that kind of like, I mean, you know, you're in a security and you go to Vegas all the time. You know, doubling your bet on black or red or doubling it a little bit more so you have an edge, you can do okay provided you're willing to walk away, right?
Oh, on a roulette, you mean?
Well, roulette or...
There's a strategy for roulette that I think it was some MIT professor came up with it back in the 60s. And, like, you follow that strategy,
right.
And, like, you will come out there was a good probability you'd come out with like more money, but right. you have to sit there the whole time and follow the strategy.
A good probability.
I think you like you will come out with the money.
But yeah, if you, you have to double there. Your bet and just keep betting black.
Yeah, there's a certain betting strategy you follow, but it's like you have to follow that strategy exactly, and you have to sit there with a large bankroll for however.
Right,
like
and
many
whenever
days.
You get ahead,
and you will win, but
no one
wants to have the discipline to do that. And occasionally, some student from MLT will go again and like prove it still works, but.
But the reason it's so hard to control for even for animals, but people are even worse, is you need to have big samples for both the control group and the experimental group, and then they need to be they're not the same, but on average are the same. So, or at least approximately the same. Same gender distribution, age distribution, height distribution of people that had diabetes, that had heart disease, all these different things, and the point is. You have to control for as many things as you can because you don't know what your medicine's going to do. Mm-hmm. Imagine the people who got phosphodiesterase inhibitors for vision acuity issues, and then they found out this was Viagra and Cialis. I mean, would they ever think to control for sexual potency in a study like that? Never.
So, I bet you there was somebody who thought about it and then just said...
Got fired?
Either fired or just thought to themselves... I can't have this meeting. I just can't. I refuse to walk in and have this meeting with somebody. You know, we gotta control
for
impotence.
Also, if they can't measure it, they can't control for it.
Right. So when we do these studies with humans, we try to get as big a sample as we can. We try to control for as many things as we can, and we can never do it perfectly. And then that's why, scientific experiments aren't all perfect.
Do you have a favorite failed experiment?
Kind of a favorite failed experiment.
And by failed experiment, I mean possibly even something that just cannot be tested, that you'd love it if we could, but just you can't do it.
Well, so there's two categories. My favorite failed experiment was cold fusion. So cold fusion, basically, you were working at the limits of statistically significant difference, the limits of detectability. You were measuring a rare event. It's the occasional extra neutron. And that difference, which was better for the particular case they were doing compared to background, had to do with the temperature dependence of that particular detector.
I'm sorry. I just blacked out.
So these are Fleischmann and Pons. Fleischmann and Pons found this, you know, they had this basically electrochemical cell, which shouldn't produce neutrons. That never would have occurred to anyone. And they got a slightly greater flux of neutrons than background, right? And it was a weird nuance of the sensitivity, and there was a temperature dependence of the detector that wasn't quite taken into account. Because actually, believe it or not, scientists at Georgia Tech, very shortly thereafter, proved that Fleischmann and Pons' results were correct. And to their credit, you know, I wonder if they really wanted to publish that. And they probably wanted to look at the temperature dependence. And literally, a few days later, they actually found the reason these results are wrong is it looks that way because of this temperature dependence. So they actually found it. But there are people, some of whom I know, who are like, well, here's the theoretical justification behind it and this. And and I don't want to pick on theorists because I do some of that stuff. You give us a curve and say, explain it, we'll come up for a theory. And then, I've got it upside down here. This is really, this is a theory. Oh, it's completely wrong.
That is
really.
The problem with smart people, though, is they can always justify anything.
So, but
you do stupid things all the time, but you can still justify it. So you're still going to do it.
They've got to
come up
with
a theory. Are you telling Pete that he's doing stupid things all the time?
No, I just say that for anybody.
No, but that's what we do. We come up with a theory, and we try to figure it out. And then you have to test it. Right? So cold fusion is my favorite one. But, a lot of people are hard on Fleischmann and Pons. You have a choice. You've discovered something, and if this were an insignificant discovery, you'd wait a few months, you'd test it, you'd look at all sorts of things. And you're weighing these two possibilities in your mind. One is, I could be wrong, and I should really check this because it's not a big difference, and I have no explanation for it yet, so this could be crazy. And on the other hand, this could be the greatest source of low-cost energy ever discovered.
Just publish it and let people try and reproduce it.
And that's what they did. So they published it, and no one could reproduce it, and they realized it was just a fluke in the experiment. And a lot of people vilified these guys.
Did that embarrass them? Because that's the thing, Trent, right?
Yes,
you don't want to publish
them.
And just try and get it reproduced because then you feel like you look like
this.
But here's your choice. On one side, you get embarrassed because you published something prematurely and people disproved it.
Okay. Do people ever publish and say, we don't know, see if you can do it? I mean, is that...
Oh, yeah. They said, we got these. And sometimes people prove that they're wrong. That happens all the time in science. That's okay. So you're a little bit embarrassed and you have to say, okay, yeah, other people have shown that this was...
I don't
was
feel you should be embarrassed. But
yeah, I don't think you should be all that embarrassed. But the point is... and they had a choice between either getting embarrassed or missing the greatest discovery of the millennium. I would have published it too, just to make sure.
To play the probabilities, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and I don't think that means, you know, their human nature played a role, and they said, look, this, if this is correct, we better do something mm-hmm. because we're in big trouble. It's kind of like, I believe that any great lesson about science or about life comes from the movies. It's kind of like, who was it? Ellie Arroway, right, who was played by, who played the woman in Contact, the scientist in Contact?
Jodie Foster.
So Jodie Foster, you know, they first got this big signal and they said, what if we're wrong? We better check this. And they checked it with an independent radio telescope in Australia. And once they realized it was not local, it wasn't the local airbase jamming or anything like that, and it's coming from Vega, he said, who are we going to call now? Everybody. And that's it. You be as careful as you can. And right, because she realized how sensitive it was. If she was wrong, the director of the National Science Foundation, who said her work was garbage, and then he wanted to be the first guy to go, we should just do a whole show on the movie Contact, because that really just...
You have to do like six shows on Contact. Carl Sagan.
Was it Stargate you said had the best depiction of a graduate student when the guy was giving the lecture and he said...
Of a graduate faculty where the woman from the government who wants to hire him, you know, she gets in a cab, it's in the rain, they laughed at his lecture, and they're walking out, and he goes, wasn't there a luncheon? And she goes, you've lost your grant, your research is washed up, you're about to be evicted from your apartment, you really have no choice but to come work for me, something like that. And what always bothers me is when people say, well, these scientists are getting rich off of global warming. No one's... I'd like to meet this guy because I'll go work for him because I just don't see that. But so the point is, any study that you see should, as Frank Fleming suggests, have a control experiment. It's hard to do it in politics. It's hard to do it in education because you got to control for the instructor, and that's more work for me. And it's hard to do with people, as Trent pointed out. But every once in a while, you see a good one. You see Charlie's supposition about the soda-rator. And the best one I had, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, is I had an abscess tooth. And I went into my dentist, and my dentist, who's very capable, tapped on the right side of my tooth where I had the abscess, and it was discomfortable. And then he tapped on the left side and said, well, does it feel worse? He did a control experiment by tapping on a healthy tooth. My endodontist, Andy, did the same thing. He looked at temperature sensitivity. He took sort of like a Freon spray, sprayed on a piece of gauze, got really cold, had me bite down on the left side and the right side, and actually compared it.
Yeah.
So kudos to my dentist and endodontist for knowing how to do a decent control experiment.
Well, they're scientifically trained, right?
Well, the good ones are. That, I will say. Physicians, dentists, and to be honest, if your plumber is good, your electrician is good, they will understand that scientific method. They will know how to formulate a hypothesis, test for it. They will understand what a good control experiment is.
You know who else knows a really good control experiment?
Who is that?
Mechanics.
Oh, absolutely. Mechanics are the only one. And the only difference between mechanics and plumbers and scientists is scientists... They make a different fashion statement. I've got the plastic vinyl pocket protector. They're being into exposed butt crack. Can I say that on the air? Exposed butt
crack? You already did.
Just okay. Hey, Pete, while we're talking about it.
exposed butt crack or pocket protector?
You're listening to WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Are at the end of the show.
I know we're at the end of the show. Right. So the question is, what have we learned? What have we learned? I was laughing too hard. I didn't really write anything down.
Between the octopi peni and the homosexual squids.
That's right. Where to start. There was a lot of there was a lot of blank in this show.
Right. What we learned is that a lot of animals are gay. That includes humans. You can't really deny it. It's biology. So get off your high horse and stop jumping up and down going, we don't like those gay people. Because to be honest, if you're heterosexual...
Hold on a second.
What?
That's a call to action.
Was that a call to action? I don't think it was. I wasn't telling
them
people to
get off their high horse.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
That's it. The FCC
can stay on your high horse.
Oh, get off your high horse. That's I mean, only my mother uses that term. But, I mean, to be honest, if still you're an educated human being and you realize people should have equality of rights, whether it's the military or whatever, because science says some people are gay, some people aren't, and there's nothing you can do about it, including squid, probably octopi as well. I think what people can't separate is the fact that if you're heterosexual, you think homosexuality is, what's the technical word, icky. Because it's not you, right? So gay people must think all these heterosexual people sucking face on every street corner. You know, they want to yell, get a room, or something like that. So it's normal for you to not find it to find it strange. One, but you can't deny that biology.
One should hope that the out groups understand better, you know, the sort of messiness and diversity of life. Mm. That's what I'm hoping.
Right, right. And it's, so homosexuality, we just saw evidence of it in Squid. I'm basically saying in your face. That may be a call to action. you know, science marches on and people get upset about it, but
this
you're always proved wrong.
This is the dirtiest inside the black box I've ever been in.
Then we saw some great examples of control experiments, not only by my dentist and endodontist, but by Charlie with his, what shall henceforth be referred to as the Soderator incident. We talked about the difference between various carbonated beverages and the fact that the whole reason you do this is shipping the water is expensive. The water comes through the tap and you take the flavoring and the carbonation, which, by the way, is unstable. The only reason it stays in there is because you put it in a bottle.
That's right. There's right? There's a big tank.
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, you know what's really scary?
Is this another Soderator?
Is this another octopus?
Popping the seal on a CO2. Yes, but popping the seal on a CO2 canister.
Oh, the little canister, the metal canister.
That's some
right.
scary stuff.
Because it pokes through the end.
You've got to push it in and then twist, and you don't know what's going to happen.
And it just kind of makes that...
Does it? No, there was no noise. If there had been a noise, we would have known it was done. But instead,
again,
you put it in there and twist it.
All those designers of computer of consumer products.
People like feedback.
People like a mechanical or electrical feedback, whether it's a click.
Let me know where I am. Let me know what has happened.
Right. And other than that, this is our last blackout show. But remember this: if ever octopi, you know, perfect the art of scuba, we're all in trouble. That is the most important lesson.
They're coming for us, man.
Okay.
Hey, who produced this show?
I'm not going to take the blame for this one. In general, I do. But if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, and we will have a real guest on next week. Pete, he will be analyzing the humor of Eddie Izzard in a scholarly fashion.
I'm going to tune into that.
All right. You should just show up. He'll be calling in. You can just... You know, make comments about carbonated soda.
Hey, it's been a pleasure to be your blackout guest.
I do appreciate that. But like I said, if you've got a question or comment or a suggestion for a future show, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our theme music is, what is it? I don't know. It's written and performed by Bill Hunt, who will be back next week after his long hiatus of trying to get that hair gel monkey off his back. And Trent Altman is our chief engineer.
When he's not in Vegas.
Or we should just call him what? Warrior King of the studio, ladies and gentlemen.
I like it.
And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week at 100,000 watts of power.
Pow!
For Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com?
Thank you.